Welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. This is the first of a two-part discussion about shared decision-making. My name is Sam, and I'm an anaesthetic reg based in Manchester. I'm joined by Stuart.
I'm Stuart. I'm an anaesthetic reg based in London. Today, we're joined by Lila, Sam, and Gemma, who will be giving us expert opinions, and we'll let them introduce themselves.
I'm Lila Finikaridis, and I used to work at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication. And most recently, I've been writing some decision aids for NHS England and rewriting some risk leaflets for the RCOA.
My name is Sam Finnegan. I'm a GP in Sutton Coalfield for half the week, and I'm also an academic at the University of Birmingham. I'm interested in personalised care and shared decision-making, and previously I was part of the NHS England Personalised Care Group as a National Clinical Specialty Advisor.
I'm Gemma Hughes, and I'm Associate Professor of Healthcare Management now at the University of Leicester Business School. I'm a social scientist. I'm now working as an academic, but I spent many years working in the NHS as a manager and a commissioner. And I have been working with the OSIRIS team, and I was involved in doing a lot of the qualitative research, which was the first project of the OSIRIS programme. And OSIRIS is the optimising shared decision making for high risk patients. And we are concerned, that programme is concerned about the need to improve the information available to patients as they're making decisions about major surgery.
Shared decision making is a hot topic. In the context of Montgomery, GMC guidance on decision making and consent, NICE guidance on shared decision making, and an increasing number of NHS England publications recommending its incorporation into healthcare pathways, CPOC has created an SDM hub, search CPOC SDM, as a central point of reference on the subject. You can't escape the phrase in the new guidelines or publications being produced, but what does it mean and how might it differ from our current ways of working? We asked our experts to set the scene and explain what the term shared decision making means to them.
Fundamentally, to me, shared decision making is about how we deliver care in the NHS, personalised care in the NHS. And it's about making sure that people get the healthcare that is right for them by making sure that our vast body of medical knowledge is applied with care to the individual in front of us in a way that makes healthcare work well for them.
To me, shared decision-making represents an intended shift from a process where a doctor might know best for a patient to a process of deciding what should happen next that involves both doctor and patient, and indeed patient's family or friends or people close to the patient. So it's something that is a change in how we understand the stages of assessment, diagnosis and treatment, to proceed from, as I say, from the kind of paternalistic doctor knows best to a more equal partnership about agreeing what is the next stage in any kind of treatment.
We talked about what shared decision making might look like, but Lila highlighted the real challenge of supporting patients to make decisions when they've consulted a specialist for guidance and advice. It may in fact represent a shift in overall practice rather than a specific directive method of consultation.
So you've got those who, I want to know the research, I want to know where I want to be able to read that paper, show me the link, I want to know where those numbers came from, and I want to know everything. Of course, there are those. And there are those who say, I just want you to tell me what to do, doctor. I don't want to get involved in all of that. And then everything in the middle. Shared decision making, to me, when I first came into this, I balked against it a little bit, because I don't necessarily want the onus to be on me as a patient. I don't ask my plumber to do shared decision-making with me about which bits of plumbing he's going to do. So there's an element, I feel personally, not speaking as, you know, part of anybody else, but personally, there's an element of, you're the specialist. You've trained X number of years. You've been doing this for X number of years. You know, I don't really want the decision. I don't want the decision to be put on me. So the term shared decision making, I don't feel, is completely, truly maybe what it is. I feel personally that it should be, I'm going to share my decision making with you, which is different.
Well, shared decision making essentially is quite a simple concept. It's making sure that when a patient is faced with any decision in their care, whether it be a treatment decision, whether to have an investigation, even where they're going to have their care delivered, that they are given options, number one, that they're told about the benefits and the risks of those options, what the alternatives are, and then they're encouraged and supported to make sure they understand that information and deliberate on it and think about how that chimes with their values and preferences so that the decision that's made is the right one for them. So fundamentally, it's not a difficult concept, but how it looks in practice is different because there's lots of influences that come into the decision-making process that might draw us away from true shared decision-making. And we can talk about those in some more detail, but things like guidelines and protocols can be sometimes quite directive. And we, as medical professionals, are sometimes trained to think there is one right answer to a problem. And we often don't have the experience, confidence, or encouragement to offer options to patients. So that first step in shared decision-making, ensuring that people are offered options, is often missed out. And if people aren't given options, then there is no decision-making. There's just consent. The idea of shared decision-making is simple. Putting it into practice is more complicated, but it's something that I think it's worth talking about.
Shared decision-making in perioperative settings is of particular interest because preceding surgery represents a more definitive decision than other continuous therapies or interventions and might also have a long-term impact on people's health and function.
It's a good question. I think one of the reasons why shared decision-making is so relevant to perioperative care and surgical environments is the issue of consent. Now, consent is something that underpins all of healthcare. But when you mention consent to people, they think about big procedures and consent forms. And yes, people consent to have blood tests and consent to take medications. But when we're talking about surgery and irreversible things, the level of consent required is more significant. Now, I want to start changing conversations about consent, and I don't think the word consent should ever be uttered without the phrase decision-making and before it. And I've been part of a team with NHS England to try and make this happen, because consent is the culmination of a process. It isn't a process in itself. The decision-making has to be done well in advance and done properly. And if decision-making is done properly through a shared decision-making process, then the consent is just the full stop at the end of the sentence. So if you talk to surgical colleagues, anaesthetic colleagues, everyone's very familiar with their obligations under, you know, consenting patients before doing anything to them. But perhaps the process leading up to consent, which is the decision-making through shared decision-making, isn't as rigorously understood and taught and acknowledged as it should be. But yeah, if I can implore one thing from today's podcast, is to not say the word consent without the words decision-making and before it.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of important reasons why shared decision-making is so important in the perioperative setting. And the first is that surgery is inevitably an irreversible process. It's a decision that is made. It's a procedure that is done. And then the consequences of that sit with the person. Unlike, for example, if a patient is entering into a program of therapy, for example, example, or even perhaps starting a course of medication, where there's a constant process of actually, is the patient going to continue with this treatment? Surgery is a harder decision, in that once the decision is made and the procedure has happened, that is actually irreversible. So I think that's the first thing. And the second thing I would say, in terms of the perioperative environment and shared decision making that we're concerned about, is that for the patients that we're most concerned about and interested in, those high risk patients, the outcomes for those patients after major surgery are often not what's expected. And even if the surgery goes well, technically, if you like, and there's no problems with either surgery or anaesthetic, it's the longer term consequences for patients that are older, have multimorbidities, who are frail, that are potentially unexpected and potentially very serious. So having a better understanding of those consequences when making the decision about whether or not to have surgery is really important. And that's the kind of basis of the OSIRIS programme.
The emphasis on decision-making and consent is a theme echoed by all three of our speakers, particularly those unintended or downstream consequences beyond the short-term recovery, or measures with significant limitations, such as 30-day mortality. When we talked about barriers or harms from shared decision-making, the conversation touched on burden sharing, health literacy, and framing decisions as life-saving.
I speak to a lot of people about decision-making, and people sometimes get concerned that the phrase shared decision-making is taking power away from patients, that by sharing a decision, that the patient isn't the ultimate arbiter of the decision. But that's not true. There is only one decision maker legally when we're dealing with competent patients, and that's the patient themselves. And nor does it mean that patients can demand any treatment they want, because the clinician is only obliged to offer reasonable options. There's another concern that's sometimes raised, that it puts too much responsibility on patients. But a distinction has to be made here between shared decision-making and informed decision-making. Informed decision-making is when you just give the patient all the information and then tell them to make a decision, which can be overwhelming for some patients. And some patients don't have the health literacy or ability to make those kind of decisions. But shared decision-making is fundamentally a supportive process. And so our obligation as clinicians is to support people to make that decision. And it's perfectly fine to give recommendations. So if a patient turns around and says, well, what would you recommend? People feel that then that's undermining shared decision-making, but it isn't in my book, because you can give a recommendation based on what you know about that person. So when people say to me, well, that's all well and good, Dr. Finnegan, but a patient will say, well, what would you recommend? And I say, well, the way that I would deal with that is I go back to them and I say, from what you've told me about what's important to you, or even take a step back and say, well, I'd like to give you a recommendation, but tell me what you think about the options, or tell me what's important to you first, and then I can give a recommendation based on what you've told me. So you're making sure that the recommendation you give is personalized to that person, rather than just the top of the list of recommendations in the guidance. So I personally don't see any disadvantages to shared decision-making. And also, I don't really want it to be perceived as something that's optional, because it's not optional. It's fundamental to our legal, moral, and professional obligations.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily see there are any harms to it as such, but making a decision and involving patients in making decisions does place potentially an extra burden on those patients. And I think there is the case to be made that being involved in making a decision, being asked to wear more information, can be experienced as a burden. It's additional work that the patient has to do. And they're being asked to do that work at a point in time when they are perhaps less able to do that. They might be feeling anxious about the procedure. They might be feeling very unwell. They may be feeling a bit overwhelmed. And that's, we know from the literature that is something that does add to this idea of sort of cognitive overload. And it's quite hard to take in information in those situations. So that's not a harm as such, but it's an added burden for the patient to have to deal with. Our research, we talk about this idea of framing and how a decision-making consultation is framed. By that, I mean how that consultation is understood and perceived by the people going to it. So if everybody going to the consultation, so the clinician, the patient, and perhaps their family member, frames and understands and expects that consultation to be about making a decision, it becomes about making a decision. Whereas if people go to it expecting it to be just the next step in the process towards surgery, it's harder to make that about a decision.
Surgical momentum and timing of decision-making conversations is crucial. In many perioperative pathways, patients don't meet an anaesthetist until the morning of surgery. They've already mentally and logistically prepared to proceed.
A friend of my mum's, so a 70-year-old, I knew was going off next week for a knee replacement. And I have to say that I already instinctively knew that I wanted to ask her some questions, but I wasn't going to show her the leaflet because she wouldn't want to know. At this point in time, she had already decided she's having her knee up. She hadn't had any conversation about anaesthetic yet. She knew that she might have a general anaesthetic or she might not, but she didn't know until the day and she didn't want to know. So I asked her general questions, but I didn't send her the leaflet until afterwards because I knew she wouldn't want to look at it. So I don't know what that says about what even I'm doing for a living. I'm writing these things and I don't even want to show them through because I knew she wouldn't want to see it. It would be too much for her.
It's not as simple as saying, just go do shared decision making. Delivering effective shared decision making hinges on how individual clinicians talk to people making decisions, but also the structures and pathways which support patient-centered care.
There's a phrase within the personalized care world that we have prepared patients, trained teams, and supportive systems. So thinking about it, those three levels. So making sure that our patients are encouraged to participate in decision-making, prepared. So that could be through written material or posters or just within the consultation, informed that there are options and decisions to be made and they are welcomed and invited to contribute. So a lot of patients don't feel that they have that permission to be involved in their decision-making. Trained teams is really important because this is not something that I think is well understood and well taught at undergraduate and postgraduate training. And it's something that we have to develop over time. It's an advanced consulting skill, essentially. The theory is very simple, but putting into practice is quite technical and quite difficult. You have to have an awful lot of knowledge, but also you have to have the ability to relinquish some control. And it feels uncomfortable. You have to change your script, your narrative, your way of consulting that we all have and we all develop over time. But changing that is very difficult and takes a lot of self-reflection. And sometimes someone else looking at your consultations and saying, well, perhaps you didn't offer that option. Or when you offered your options, you were clearly leaning towards one and influencing the decision. So training is actually something that's quite difficult. And then you have to work in a system that supports you to do this. Supports you by making sure that resources are available, that you have the time and the opportunity. If a patient is not blowing through a system and given opportunities to ask questions before they end up in an anaesthetic room, then it's not really the time to start making decisions about what they want. So if the system isn't supporting you to have those conversations with patients, then it makes it very difficult to do it well. As far as benefits for patients, well, patients, I think, should be used to being involved in decision-making throughout their life. You wouldn't go and buy a car or a financial product or a new computer without finding out information, thinking about your options, and perhaps talking to an expert. And yet when it comes to healthcare, we seem to accept that people just turn up and get told what they're going to get. And it seems strange that these are some of the biggest decisions that we make in life. So I think we should trust patients to want to be involved in their healthcare and get involved. And the benefit is that they get the right healthcare for them. There's this concept of preference misdiagnosis. We're used to people being misdiagnosed medically, and it's a tragedy when it happens. But equally, people can have their preferences diagnosed, and that's why they get a treatment or an intervention that is not the one that they wanted. They didn't want an intervention. And if we misdiagnose people's preferences, we end up giving them the wrong thing. And that's bad for the patient. It's completely avoidable by making sure that people are fully involved in the decision-making process and thereby making the right decision for them?
Yeah, so we've found these different kinds of consultation in our data. And some of those features were features of the organisational environment and the setting. So where we found patients were kind of, if you like, pre-warned that this was going to be about a decision, that was in a setting, it was a smaller hospital setting where they'd already had some contact with the surgeon that they were going to sit down and talk to. And that surgeon had already pre-warned them, if you like, that, yeah, obviously you're talking to me as a surgeon, but there's some other things going on here we need to talk about. So that was partly about timing and having that lead in an expectation that the consultation was going to be about a decision. But there was also a bit of continuity that was enabled by the fact that this was a smaller hospital. It wasn't a big regional centre where patients will often just see their surgeon for the first time when they're having that consult, that conversation. So I think that's one of the facilitators of having a greater preparation for that discussion. Obviously, during the consultation itself, there are certain approaches that people can take that are more collaborative, and having time to go through the different options, having time to almost co-produce the options, not just saying, here are the options, which one do you want, but talking through what the possibilities might be and then turning those into a list that you then decide about. That requires quite a bit of time. And you know how busy people are in clinical settings. It's quite hard sometimes to create that time and space to do that.
We heard some really interesting insights on risk communication and patient experiences.
So there are a number of issues around risk communication with clinicians. It's whether you as clinicians know the, I'm going to say in inverted commas, but the right risk to communicate. Do you know the numbers? Do you know what research are you getting them from? Is it up to date? Is it in light guidance from NICE? Because when we have been writing the decision aids, we always like to bring risk down into a way that people can understand, which is usually it's a frequency, right? So it's X, 1 in 100, 2 in 100, 12 in 100, so that people can compare and you know what they're talking about. What we find often is that in the research and in the NICE guidance, risk isn't always presented in that way. You're often getting insanity like odds ratios and hazards ratios and relative risks that are not really useful to somebody unless you've got a baseline risk, have you? So clinicians knowing the risk to communicate in the first place, so them having the right tools is difficult, you know, them having the right information in the first place. Some are doing great. Some are doing really, 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 really well. And some have a little way to go. But all have been, anybody that I've spoken to, have been open to wanting to be able to do it better. All of them. So all of, even the surgeons who, you know, think they're doing it right. I met one once who said, everybody understands percentages. Of course they do. And I had to explain to them, you know, because of X factor, I'll give it 110%, or footballers, I'll give it 150%. People don't know how many a percentage is out of. They ask, how many is that out of? So, yes.
If we give people what Montgomery is telling us is it's not okay to give people a standard list of risks with 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1,000,000 written next to the risks, and think that we've fulfilled our obligation to communicate the risks of surgery. But equally, I think it does set a high standard in trying to understand what that person thinks would be meaningful. But I think you can overthink it, because actually what it's saying is, talk to your patient about what's important to them, what they're concerned about, what the common risks are, and find out what matters to that person. And in doing so, because you know all the information anyway about the procedure, you can then highlight things that are likely to be relevant to them. And although the Montgomery standard has changed that consent process away from the the more clinician-centered way of doing things, you're still only expected to operate at the standard of a clinician. And if you can demonstrate that you have understood what's important to that person and done everything you can to communicate the risks and benefits of surgery in a personalized way, then I think that the law and the profession will back you up if you don't mention a really rare thing that might happen to have been relevant to that person or meaningful to that person. But I don't think it's been fully tested yet. And I think that probably would cause some anxiety amongst people. But fundamentally, if we're moving away from standardized lists of risks and moving more to conversations, then we're winning. Just as long as people are not stuck in that paradigm of listing masses of potential risks and overwhelming the person with information so that nothing really is relevant to them. I'm not a lawyer.
Sam and Layla shared some amazing insights into how humans make decisions and the role of patient decision aids to support and structure decision making.
It's like any aspect of your role. You wouldn't be expected to go and, you know, take blood for the first time without somebody showing you how to do it. You know, how are you supposed to know how to do this unless somebody tells you? I used to work for the BBC, so I know what it's like when you have incessant amounts of online training courses that pop up on your screens that you have to do. And you're in the middle of whatever you're doing. You haven't got time to do them. It's really, really difficult to find time and enthusiasm to sit and, you know, do a course or do a 20-minute. So what we've been doing with the decision aids, we were asked to make PDF decision aids, so essentially pieces of paper. And in doing that, I spoke to a lot of patients, of normal people, and I spoke to a little expert group. But I also, of course, then spoke to what I call normal clinicians. So I went out and found, you know, the relevant nurses and GPs and surgeons and whoever. And in doing the decision aids, I found that what I actually wanted to create was a perfect consultation. I wanted to create a piece of paper, or, you know, a number of pieces of paper, that essentially was, okay, I go into the doctor or surgeons or whoever it is room as a patient, and they tell me all of this stuff. And I'm supposed to think about it and go away or make a decision or whatever it is I'm supposed to do and go home and remember it all. And I'm always, always, always saying to any GP I see, give your patients a piece of paper and a pen when they walk in the room and tell them to make notes. I do. I record mine on my phone these days. But in doing these things, we found that what would be really useful is this perfect consultation.
It's really important to acknowledge the fact that clinicians are human, and as humans, we're flawed. And I don't think that we acknowledge that enough. And being aware of our own biases are important. And that's okay. We're allowed to have opinions. We're allowed to have biases. But we need to be aware of them and be open and honest about them. And the other issue of heuristics is really important. Actually, heuristics are our decision-making shortcuts that we make. And we all make them because they allow us to get through the day. One of the biggest barriers I feel to shared decision-making is the fact that we have to approach each decision-making point with an open mind and make effortful decision-making rather than automatic decision-making. And that inevitably is more effort. So we need to give ourselves the time and space and mental energy to engage in that rather than just simply going through the process that we would with every person every time and build up new habits, new mental habits that allow us to do this. And a lot of people, clinicians, are having the same conversations again and again and again. There may be only a few procedures or a few treatments that you're involved with as a clinician. And so it makes it a little bit easier because you can be all over the evidence, the risks and the benefits. You can learn how scripts, essentially, how to communicate those in an effective way, which allows you to preserve your mental energy with the application of that to the care of that person and that person's individual preferences and values. It's not easy, but recognizing that there are those biases and heuristics are an important part of it. And we can't get rid of them because that's the nature of it. We just have to deal with them. And the other thing that can help is having some arbiter of the truth in the room. So whether that be a decision support tool or some document that has the benefits and risks laid out. So there's no room for us to fudge them, essentially, no room for us to influence things by saying, oh, well, this one's the best.
That's the end of the first part in this two-part podcast about shared decision-making. A huge thanks to all our speakers. Make sure to click on to the second part, where we'll hear more from our speakers about how we might actually do shared decision-making in practice, and whether it's more important for particular patients, and we talk a little bit about high-risk patients. You can find the next part in the Royal College of Anaesthetists podcast feed. Thanks a lot. Thank you.